Space policy impacts on Florida and leaks on the ISS. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. With a new presidential administration, Florida's Space Coast could see big changes when President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Will Trump help keep the Artemis moon missions on track? Could SpaceX potentially put humans on Mars in just the next few years? And how could private aerospace companies stand to gain? We'll speak with Greg Autry, author and associate provost for space at the University of Central Florida, about what space policy could look like in Florida over the next 4 years. Then, after over two decades in orbit, the International Space Station is beginning to show its age. As the station gets older, the durability of the ISS is starting to decline, and it's leaking. But are these leaks and other issues catastrophic for the station? We'll speak with Florida Tech's Don Platt about these questions and the legacy of the ISS. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Florida's commercial space sector could be entering a new era of exploration as Donald Trump returns to the Oval Office as the 47th President of the United States. Under his last administration, Trump made big moves to expand human exploration missions, and now commercial space companies are looking towards the future to see what Florida's Space Coast will look like under another Trump administration. And one of those companies, SpaceX, is looking towards the future, including landing humans on Mars within this decade. But what will space policy look like in Florida for these private aerospace companies? Could we land humans on Mars? And can we make it to the moon within the next 2 years? And how might Elon Musk's relationship with the president-elect affect commercial space and federal space policies? Well, here to answer those questions is Greg Autry, Associate Professor of Space Commercialization and Strategy at the University of Central Florida and author of Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Greg, I know you're a recent transplant to UCF, but you have done a lot of work here in Florida. I want to start by asking, if you could give the Florida space industry a grade right now, what would it be?
B+.
Okay. That's pretty good. That's a good GPA, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, they're certainly succeeding. I have a house in Melbourne, actually, with a dock, and I sit there and watch space launches happen every day, or sometimes I think it's twice a day, right? So things are getting done. I think that the cooperation in Florida between the government at the state level, the federal institutions at Kennedy Space Center and Space Force, and the commercial sector is really well managed, better than anywhere else.
As you alluded to, that is by design, right? I mean, there has been a lot of resources put in by the state to make this happen, right?
Exactly. And very often when that happens, those things don't go well, but this is a case where I think the right people were put in the right place, and the vision had a scope that was achievable, and they've done a remarkably good job. And then good cooperation from folks like Bob Cabana at NASA, who helped build Park outside of KSC, where you've got all that Blue Origin stuff going on, and a lot of other small companies taking advantage of the ecosystem. And then all the way up to Jacksonville, you've got Redwire up there, and you've got space companies over to Tampa. The academic institutions, UCF, of course, is Space U and has always been leading there, but you've got Embry-Riddle and Florida Tech and UF all interested in space. So it's a good place to be.
I know you were involved with the first Trump administration's transition. I remember when I covered that election, Vice President Mike Pence was here in Florida quite often touting space. I want you to talk a little bit about the Trump administration's first year in office and how, from the federal side of things, how that helped boost what was happening here in Florida.
So I had the opportunity to join the Trump agency review team at NASA in 2016, around this time of the year, in fact, and here we are 8 years later. President Trump had an interest in space, and he, frankly, is somebody who always likes to do whatever he's going to do best and biggest. That shouldn't surprise anybody. So he had an expansive look at it. And, you know, frankly, we were blessed that Mike Pence took a personal interest in space and really dug in. And like you mentioned, he was here all the time. He showed up at space conferences at Colorado Springs at the Space Symposium. He conducted 8 Space Council meetings in 4 years. The recent administration's only done 3 in their 4 years. And he was just genuinely interested and responsive and understood the details. Congress gave us bipartisan support to do some bolder things, and we were able to make decisions like return to the moon, re-stand up the Space Council, kind of lay the groundwork that set up for the Space Force to be done later. And it was an exciting time to be engaged, frankly.
And what happened in the past 4 years? Did that momentum continue through the Biden administration?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the Biden administration continued essentially all of the Trump space policy. To some extent, though, I think it's been benign neglect. They didn't care enough to make a substantial change. They were really slow on making appointments, particularly to the National Space Council's user advisory group. There wasn't a lot of action, but they didn't undo anything. And that's a blessing because normally every time you get a new administration, everything has to reboot at NASA, and that's frustrating. So that didn't happen. The appointments that the Biden team made, I have great respect for. Senator Nelson's kept the boat on track, and Pam Elroy, the deputy, is great. Mm-hmm. Rich DiBello runs the Office of Space Commerce, has always been a good friend of mine. But I do feel that there wasn't a passion about it. And when we've run into trouble, and we've run into a lot of trouble, particularly on Artemis, there was nobody from the White House to come in and give cover. When the NASA science budget got crushed by the Republican Congress, nobody fought about it, right? Nobody went into horse trade and tried to get the science missions back on track. So those things have concerned me. We're at a point where there are definitely problems at NASA that need to be addressed immediately.
That alludes to my next question, is talking about the next 4 years under President-elect Trump and a new Trump administration. You mentioned that there are some problems that need to be solved, SLS being one of them. Tell me a bit about what needs to change in order for that to be successful and for President-elect Trump to meet that Artemis deadline that he set.
My concern with Artemis in particular is that every major component is behind schedule and over budget or in trouble in some way. So you'd Collins just walk away from the spacesuit contract that they had agreed to because they couldn't make money. The mobile launch system is behind schedule and is now costing more than the Burj Khalif in Dubai. The human lander system behind schedule, even though we've got two landers there. SpaceX would argue that they're behind schedule because the government's been holding up their iterative testing and launch process. All these things need to be addressed. Now, you mentioned SLS. Ironically, we're in a situation where SLS actually is fairly stable and works, but the mobile launcher's not there, and now we've got a problem with Orion's heat shield that, for some reason, and this baffles me, the folks at headquarters NASA say, we know what it is, but we're not telling you. So this AV coat...
That's a bit concerning, right?
Yeah. So my gut feeling is that Artemis 2 is at great risk, and so what are you going to do if you have an SLS core ready and you don't have a capsule that can perform the mission?
Can Trump make space great again in the next 4 years, though? What you've outlined is a lot that needs to change.
Yeah, and on top of that, you've got Elon in the mix now, right? Mm-hmm. So he stepped in relatively late in the campaign, but he's been obviously a key mover for the Trump campaign. He's obviously meeting with President-elect routinely. Obviously, he cares about NASA. I don't know that he said anything publicly about it, but clearly he's passionate about that. He wants to go to Mars. He's jumping up and down on a campaign stage with Trump wearing an Occupy Mars shirt, and Trump agrees that he should go to Mars. So that's a whole new mission set on a very crazy aggressive schedule, 2026 and 2028 for these launch windows to Mars. There's just a whole lot to do to make that work while getting Artemis back on track, fixing the issues with the NASA science programs and budget.
Now, while there was very large funding for NASA under Trump's administration, there was a little bit of a budget dip. Something's going to have to give, right, if there is an increased focus on these human spaceflight programs like Artemis, like humans on Mars. Are there any concerns that money is going to come from somewhere else, like sciences or earth sciences or even climate observations within NASA?
In my opinion, I think you could see a budget uplift if the president believes that it's warranted. He's not somebody who does things on the cheap. And the NASA budget, frankly, is 0.3-something percent of the federal budget. You wouldn't notice if you eliminated the whole thing. So adding $10 billion to NASA, it's a big number for you and me. In the scope of the federal budget, it wouldn't make a difference. If it achieves big geopolitical wins...
And he's got the capital for it, right? He's got both houses, the House and Senate, that would
allocate
that, right?
Wasn't really a luxury we had in the past. Now, that said, also, you've got Elon wanting to go to Mars, but I think to a great extent, what he wants to do on Mars using Starship aligns with what he's already being paid to do by NASA for the human lander system on the moon, and he's likely to put his own private capital in to some extent. So the key thing is to bring in enough money to cause multiple amounts of that funding to come in from the private sector. And in areas like commercial LEO destinations, the space stations, if we get a better commitment out of NASA and perhaps even DOD to be anchor tenants there, we can get that private investment flowing back in. And I think under Trump, it's more likely to that private investment retreated a little bit the last 3 years or so. And I think we could see that come back and help get a lot more done with a lot less. Now, you mentioned science, and that really concerns me. We've seen the Viper mission canceled, but apparently we're actually going to fly the mission because we paid for a launch, and we're not going to put the rover in. We're going to put in a mass simulator, basically. You've had to basically run when the Mars sample return off the tracks, we don't know what we're doing there. We've got an issue where JPL's laid off a whole bunch of workers. So I don't want to see all that. I think science is the one thing that government can do that the private sector is not going to step up for. Private sector is not going to build the Dragonfly mission to go to Titan, right? They're not going to build a Europa Clipper. So how do we make sure those things happen? I think there's broad bipartisan support in Congress for that. It just needs a champion and a belief that the American public's money is being well treated. Mars sample return got out of control, just like JWST got out of control.
A big player in private aerospace industry is SpaceX, headed by Elon Musk. Elon Musk has the ear of the president-elect Trump and is serving in one of his capacities in the administration. Is there concern from the private companies that are out there that are competitors with SpaceX, that this may tip the scales in SpaceX's favor?
Oh, I'm sure there is, right? And even if there isn't, they would make noise about it. And there are people who just don't like Elon for whatever reason who'll certainly make noise about it. That's, you know, already happening. That said, I don't believe any of these rumors like Elon is going to be appointed NASA administrator. That's crazy. He's got better things to do and he's already doing them. That said, can he advise the president on a number of things? I think so.
One of the things that Elon has been quite vocal about is kind of lessening some of these government regulations, especially with the FAA for launch licensing and the iterative testing that SpaceX does. The whole industry stands to gain from that, right? If some of those restrictions are lessened?
Yeah, and I don't know that it's as much about the actual restrictions, laws, or rules as it is about the process of going through them in a timely manner, right? Everybody wants to be safe, particularly the third-party uninvolved public. Nobody wants something taking off from the Cape and landing at Disney World, right? Then you've got the issue of safety for potential spaceflight participants and the operating crew on the ground. But we want folks to be safe. There's 100% agreement on that. But point is, when the process takes months and months and months for each and every test flight, it's not taking into account the fact we live in a competitive geopolitical world. The Chinese and the Russians are moving forward with their International Lunar Research Station and with their launches. So, but we've got to be competitive, so we can't restrain our own industry pretending that we have forever to get it right.
Another possible concern from the commercial space industry would be Trump's tariffs. Do you foresee that if these tariff policies are enacted, that the supply chain may really feel the brunt of this and could have some tough impact on the Central Florida aerospace economy?
First of all, one of the good news there is that of all industrial supply chains, the space supply chain is the most domestic because national security has driven us to do everything we can to keep it clean. That said, if there were tariffs on basic raw materials, there could be a short-term interruption. But the goal of the tariffs, when they're strategic, particularly on materials, is to encourage U.S. production. So 20 years ago, all of the rare earth elements, or like 80% of the rare earth elements in the world, were mined in California at the Mountain Pass mine on the Nevada border. Now that all the material that's mined there is now shipped to China for processing and then sold back to the U.S. So could we fix that? Yeah, I think we could fix that, right? And so the tariffs would create an economic motivation to fix that, which would give us a better supply chain in the long run. There's that short term versus long term. And then whether you believe or not that the tariffs could be effective in making the long term, I do. And I think we're going to be okay. And I think that national security exemptions will always exist. And anything to do with national spaceflight will have a clear national security exemption. So.
Finally, Greg, I want to ask you, when I think back to presidential administrations and big space news headlines, I think to Trump's first term return to human spaceflight with DM2, Bob and Doug, SpaceX.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
When you think of the Biden administration, you think of Artemis 1 finally getting off the ground. I'm going to ask you to look to your crystal ball here. What is going to be the big headline for Trump's second term when it comes to space?
Well, A, I hope that Artemis gets back on track and we put human boots on the moon and that our first Artemis astronauts are there before 2028. And then, you know, Elon says he wants to land starships on Mars in 2026 and 2028. I don't know if he can make the 2026, but I would be surprised if we don't see starships on Mars in 2028, probably uncrewed. But you've also got to realize if you can put one down there with 100 tons of material or multiple ones, each with 100 tons of material, the crew doesn't have to come back anytime soon. And that's a totally different way of thinking for NASA. But as long as you know that you can deliver unmanned vehicles there with supplies, then obviously we can deal with issues of food, water, and radiation, as long as you can deliver materials.
Greg Autry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Greg Autry, an associate provost for space commercialization and strategy at the University of Central Florida, and author of Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. Still to come, how do you fix an air leak in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Is your car telling you that your tire pressure is low? Mine is. But it's a pretty easy fix, right? But what happens when the International Space Station is leaking air? The ISS has had leak issues before, but new leaks are raising concerns over how long the orbiting outpost can last. It was built to withstand 15 years in orbit, but now has been used for over 25, and there are no plans to retire until 2030. Here to talk about the ISS, its legacy, and old age is Don Platt, Associate Professor of Space Systems at Florida Institute of Technology. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, Don, the ISS is leaking. That doesn't seem like a good thing, right?
No, indeed. One thing it has to do is keep air in it so that the astronauts have no issues with breathing. But unfortunately, there are some leaks that are developing as it's getting older.
Has this been going on for a while, or is this a relatively new phenomenon to happen on the ISS?
You know, there are always little leaks here and there. It's very hard to maintain an atmosphere when the outside is a vacuum. You know, they've had a few small leaks here and there through the years, but nothing quite as significant or as long-lasting as what they're facing now as the space station's getting so much older.
How are these leaks determined in the first place? I assume you can't, like, put some soapy water on it like you would a tire and see where the bubbles are. How do you find a leak on an International Space Station?
Well, you can actually do sort of an experiment where you're holding something that can get kind of sucked towards a hole. It could even be like a piece of paper or something and see where it is essentially being drawn to, or even a little bit of steam or anything like that can give you a little bit of an indication about a direction of where a leak is occurring in it.
But what could be causing these?
The space station has to maintain this fairly significant pressure. I mean, it's essentially 15 pounds per square inch of pressure that it is fighting all the time against the vacuum of space. And so there are cycles involved with this. There are thermal cycles involved. Of course, the space station has about 15 orbits a day. And so that means that it goes through the shadow of the Earth 15 times a day. And in space, that makes those components, as they go through the shadow of the Earth, get pretty cold. And then as they get back into the sunny side of the orbit, they'll heat up quite a bit. So there's lots of thermal cycles. So that provides a lot of stress and strain on the vehicle. There are actually stresses induced on the overall space station every time a new spaceship docks to the space station or undocks from the space station. So there are a significant number of kind of stress-inducing events that do occur throughout the lifetime of the overall system.
Not only is the space station fighting against the vacuum of space, it's going through these incredibly polarizing thermal changes multiple times a day. Are the materials that are used to build the space station and these parts of the station tested for this? And I mean, how long are these materials supposed to last?
In all honesty, the space station was only anticipated to last maybe up to about 15 years. And the elements that are facing some of these problems were put up in space around 1998, 1999, during that time frame. So we're already looking at about 25 years. And the materials are typically aluminum materials. They're very strong, but very lightweight, similar materials to what they build airplane fuselages out of that also see a lot of stressful cycles throughout their lifetime.
Do we know, like, what the size is of these current leaks? Are we talking something quite large, like cracking a windshield, or something very, very small, like a pinhole or something?
Yeah, I like to use the example of maybe a slow leak in a tire. Essentially, maybe you're using your dashboard tire gauge, and you're looking at it, and oh, gee, it's a PSI lower than it was yesterday. By the end of the week, I'm probably going to have to go to the gas station and put more air in my tire. So it's kind of like that. It's a fairly small, if almost microscopic crack, but of course, any gas likes to get through any opening that it can find.
With a tire, you can plug it. With a space station, can you do the same thing?
In some instances, you can. The big issue is, will this crack just keep growing, though? Around a tire, you've sort of got a uniform surface there that really resists cracking. Usually what happens with a tire is you're getting a puncture from some external source. But here, you've got an actual material failure. And so it's quite possible that over time, this crack could get bigger.
Is there a way to quarantine where these cracks are happening? Can they shut some doors if need be and extend the life of the space station if these cracks do indeed get larger?
Yeah, indeed. I think they're starting to do that now. These cracks are near an area where the Russian Progress resupply modules come and dock to the space station to bring equipment and supplies and food and things like that to the station. And so while they do not need to either have a Progress dock or get into a Progress that's already docked, they'll close a hatch and that'll kind of isolate this issue to that one small area. So yes, indeed, they can, kind of like with a submarine. If you've ever been on a submarine or visited a museum that is a submarine, you'll see they have all these hatches, and so they can close those hatches as needed.
Was that by design, Don, or is this kind of a happy accident that they have the modular system of the ISS?
No, it was definitely by design. One of the reasons why NASA was originally interested in having the Russians involved in the space station was their tremendous amount of experience with space stations. And in fact, the station that the Russians operated before the International Space Station was called the Space Station Mir. And that Mir station had a variety of different types of issues. They had a Progress module crash into it. They had a fire on board. So they had a lot of operational experience. And in either of those situations, they would have to seal off a part of that Mir space station in order to, you know, for instance, you could suck out all the atmosphere and put out the fire. Or again, if you had a crack or an induced leak from an accident like that, then you would also want to seal it off. So this was definitely part of the plan.
Don, you mentioned the age of the space station, almost a quarter of a century at this point, and how it was designed for something like 15 years, I think you mentioned. Can we expect some massive overhauls to the space station, given some of these issues that it's having right now?
No, it's really kind of in the stopgap kind of mode, really, honestly. They're going to make sure it is safe and that the crew members on board are safe, and so they'll do everything they can do to make sure that there aren't any issues that are really life-threatening. But they're definitely not going to swap out the module or do anything major at this point. I don't think anybody has the inclination to do that. Certainly NASA does not have the budget to do that. They're going to make sure they can keep operating it safely, but they're just kind of going to baby it along here like you would with your old car and begrudgingly maybe fix a small thing here or there because you just had to make sure it could stay on the road. But overall, nothing major is going to change on space station.
You mentioned there was so much knowledge about these systems from the Russians and the U.S. partner with them for the ISS. Now, the next generation of space stations is going to be from the commercial industry. Are these commercial companies looking to the ISS and some of these problems that it's having and using that to kind of future-proof their designs?
Yeah, definitely. You know, NASA is going to contract with these commercial space stations, so there will be an exchange of knowledge or lessons learned, if you will, from everything that has happened on the International Space Station. And these new commercial stations will be able to benefit from that knowledge. And that's always one good thing about NASA programs is that they're pretty open with reports and technical information about what went right or what went wrong with a particular space mission. And so these industrial partners can definitely benefit from all of that information and knowledge to move forward with a safe, effective, and hopefully lower cost commercial space station.
Thinking back to the International Space Station, the leaks are a sign of its age. Are there any other issues propping up on the International Space Station that NASA is keeping a watchful eye on, or folks like you are keeping a watchful eye on as it reaches its end of life?
Well, certainly any component that is moving, like a motor, for instance, is always a concern. And there are plenty of motors and pumps on the space station. Many of them are involved with the environmental control life support system, essentially the systems that pump the air through the station and make sure it can maintain temperature. Any of those pumps could fail over time. There are some spares, and they've done a good job of outfitting spares. And the station was designed to have the ability to change out many components on orbit, but anything that is a moving part is a concern. Electronics over time actually can wear out in terms of the exposure to the radiation environment, the thermal environment, the similar temperature extremes that we talked about before. So those are definitely areas of concern. The solar panels are exposed to lots of thermal cycles as well, and they just naturally degrade over time, and so they are not putting out as much power now as they did when they were put on the station to begin with near the end of the space shuttle program in the, about 2008 to 2010 time period. So those are things that I would be looking at from the point of view of NASA to make sure that they're aware of any issues that may be cropping up as we move forward.
And finally, Don, there's a whole generation of people that lived in a world where there has been a permanent presence in space via the International Space Station. And as we talk, more and more about its end of life. I know you've had a long career dealing with payloads and systems related to the International Space Station. Is this a moment of sadness as it reaches its final hours and days in space?
Yeah, absolutely. It has really revolutionized space exploration, honestly. The commercial space industry that is so vibrant today, so much of it owes its beginnings to the International Space Station. SpaceX, really, their first big contract with the government was with NASA to resupply the International Space Station. And then NASA showed even more faith in SpaceX by giving them the contract to bring astronauts to the International Space Station. And that allowed then SpaceX to get in with the Department of Defense and launch some of the military-related satellites as well. And we all know where SpaceX is today. There's a variety of other commercial companies that really have started by doing services and experiments and payloads on the International Space Station. I think for the future of humanity in space, it's important that we maintain this continuous presence in space. We're always able to do experiments. We're always able to test new ideas. And in an environment that's relatively safe and easy to get back from in low Earth orbit on the International Space Station. So I just really do not want to see us in a situation like we were when the space shuttle retired. When the shuttle retired, then the United States was handicapped in that they could no longer bring their own astronauts into space. And so we don't want to have a situation where the United States does not have a place to conduct research and do experiments in space. The Chinese are really successful now with their brand new space station that's really just at the beginning of its life in comparison to the International Space Station. So these are all things that we have to think about as we move forward towards the end of the life of the station.
And when you think about those things, Don, are you optimistic that the commercial industry will fill in those gaps at a fast enough pace that we will not be without a permanent presence up there?
Cautiously optimistic. I think that other than SpaceX, so many other commercial space companies realize that space is a lot harder than maybe they thought it was. We've seen a lot of companies that have really bold ambitions and they've struggled to really live up to those ambitions. And so I do have a little bit of a concern, although several of these commercial space station groups are actually have a number of people working with them and as part of their management team and high-level teams that were NASA high-level officials too and officials throughout the International Space Station program. And so hopefully that knowledge and experience can help them to make sure that they get their space station up and running so we do not have this situation where the station is just too old, we've got to splash it in the ocean and we do not have a replacement.
We've been speaking with Don Platt, Associate Professor of Space Systems at Florida Institute of Technology. Don, thanks so much for your insight, as always.
Great. That was fun. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you've got an idea for a future episode of this show or want to join us as a guest, shoot us an email. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage online at cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.